91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with the mayor of Coral Gables, Jim Kaysen, a veteran public service and foreign service expert. He has 45 years of experience in the field. An ambassador to Paraguay and chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana. An advisor to NATO and more service in other Latin American countries and Europe. He's the president of the Center for a Free Cuba. Jim Kaysen is 1 year into his third term in Coral Gables. He had the U.S. Interest Section helm for 3 years. In Cuba, he gained media satirical attention as Cabo Kaysen. And get this, Kaysen has recorded an album of Paraguayan folk songs in the indigenous Guarani language. Stay tuned. Meet Mayor Jim Kaysen after the news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you solo this afternoon. Bonnie has the day off. Well, Coral Gables has been cited by Forbes magazine as one of the top 10 cities to live well in. The Wall Street Journal says it's one of the most walkable cities in the country. USA Today confirms it as one of America's top 10 romantic cities. Well, Coral Gables has beauty, history, location, and elegance to spare. So we're now joined by Coral Gables Mayor, Ambassador James Kaysen. James Kaysen has led a very fascinating life, much of it in foreign service hotspots. He's been U.S. Ambassador to Paraguay. He was Chief of Mission U.S. Interest Section in Havana. And he served in many Latin American countries as well as in Europe. And he joined us now by phone. Thank you for joining us, Coral Gables Mayor Jim Kaysen.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Could you reflect upon your long career with the U.S. State Department? You were even lauded in the book Our Man in Panama.
Yes, I had a wonderful 38-year career with the Foreign Service, something that I always wanted to be a member of. Since I was living in French Morocco on a French naval base when I was really little, seeing Morocco break away from France, all the turmoil got me very interested in international affairs. I read Churchill's collected works then and said my goal would be to go to college and then eventually join the Foreign Service. And so I started off in El Salvador and ended up living in Italy, Spain, Portugal, Morocco, twice in Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, Venezuela, let's see, Panama, Salvador, Honduras, Cuba, and Jamaica. So it was a long 38-year career, 19 assignments, and among them as political advisor to the NATO commander. And I also directed export promotion for the U.S. out of Milan, Italy, and Italian. So a lot of fun. You have to live around the world, experience a lot of cultures, learn a lot of language, and best career I could ever have chosen. And I recommend it for anybody that wants to live abroad and experience all the great things that are out there in the world.
You were certainly stationed in so many hot spots in the world, and particularly this hemisphere. Was there some James Bond element to you?
No, but I just happened to, I always picked hardship posts, and it turned out when I got there, there was a revolution. I was in Bolivia and Panama. I was in Portugal during the revolution, and as a political officer, that was the best place to be when all kinds of things were happening and unexpected. So I just turned out that I was in all these interesting places, the South Atlantic dispute when Argentina and England had at it. So it was a sort of what goes with Foreign Service life. You never know what's going to happen when you get to a country, and usually there's something you'll find very interesting there, and that was the case for me. A lot of really interesting places.
Not too many people remember that Falklands, Mariana, brouhaha. It really made Margaret Thatcher.
It did. I was there. Uruguay at the time was basically the only neutral country in Latin America, so it had a lot of pressure from Argentina not to be neutral, but it was a place that was created by the Brits and it, as a buffer between Argentina and Brazil. And during the South Atlantic dispute, as I call it, the wounded British troops were brought through and also prisoners were exchanged. So it played an important role as a site for transfer of prisoners and wounded people. And actually, I got thrown out of Uruguay by the military government on human rights grounds because I was supporting Kissinger asked me to try to broker a prisoner exchange between Tupamaro guerrillas and dissidents in the Soviet Union. And the military government didn't like that. And so they gave in to Argentine pressures and said, throw him out. So that was an interesting time to get thrown out by a right-wing military dictator.
Did you have meetings with Henry Kissinger?
No. This was all done by, I met him on a number of occasions, but this was all done by diplomatic cable.
You must have a lot of classified information up your sleeve, too.
Well, everything that, before WikiLeaks, we thought everything we wrote was classified, but everything's declassified now.
Anything embarrassing?
No, I think what people found was when they read our diplomatic cables, I think the first impression was, wow, this is some really good insights and good writing, because we were basically considered ourselves as diplomats, not only lobbyists, but also and program directors, because we ran a lot of programs in support of human rights and training prosecutors and people that wanted to fight corruption. But also we were the equivalent of New York Times reporters, but we just reported to the federal government. And usually it was classified to protect the people that provided us information who were basically interested in getting their points of view out to the U.S. government.
So a lot of your time must have been spent in combing sources and making sure that you had information lines open.
Well, to be a successful diplomat, you have to get out in the community. You know, you arrive, you don't know anybody, it's a different language usually. And I did this in Portuguese, Italian, Spanish, and Guarani. And you would arrive in a different country, not know anybody, pick up the Constitution, start reading, and then once you got the lay of the land, you would go out and try to meet 200 or 300 people. They could provide you information when the U.S. government was interested in a particular topic or you wanted to promote the U.S. point of view on an issue that was important for bilateral relations. So to be successful, you had to really get out and meet people as well as have good basic information. I did something unusual, which was that wherever I went, I tried to find out who owned the country. So I spent a lot of time at the public registry. And at the end, maybe have 15,000 companies and everybody associated with it. So put them in family trees, and then you would be able to know an awful lot from the family relationships, because that's how businesses tend to be organized in Latin America.
I suppose
give you a lot of insights.
I suppose many of those key players are rather shadowy figures and don't want to have a lot of exposure.
Some were, but generally, depending on what country you were in and who the ambassador wanted you to meet with, good ambassadors would urge you to go out and meet people on the right and the left, military officers, labor union, student leaders. So you would try to develop a very wide network of regular people as well as community leaders in order to have a good insight as to what's going on. Not much different than a New York Times reporter.
With your long history and experience in Latin America, how would you characterize the U.S. policy over the past few decades when you were active? Something you're pleased with? Or?
When the Cold War was over, the focus then turned to anti-corruption, because so many of the problems of Latin America caused by corrupt governments, and when they didn't have the support of the people, they would turn to either a military model, or most recently wave was left-wing populist. And there was a real yearning for clean and honest government. And so we found that U.S. government had a lot of expertise in the Justice Department and Treasury and elsewhere that we bring experts in and work with the government, sometimes under what was called the Millennial Challenge Account, which was a program to support countries fighting corruption to improve in areas that they thought were important. And we would work with vetted units, people that were honest and wanted to tackle the corruption. You see a lot of this going on in Brazil now with a very strong effort by the judiciary to bring honesty to a very corrupt government. And so we did a lot of that. A lot of my later years was running programs in customs, in the Ministry of Finance, in the prosecutor's office to train these people that wanted to fight corruption in their own country.
Now, for 3 years, you were the mission chief for the U.S. interest section in Havana. That must have been a very interesting post. But in that light, I'd really be interested in your view of the president's recent Cuba trip.
Well, the president, I think, was very interested in his legacy. He wanted to be the president that led to an opening in Cuba, like Nixon in China. And so he wanted to try something different. I have a different point of view. I think that from what I observed in Cuba, the elite that run the military, it's really a military dictatorship that runs Cuba, and they enjoy lots of privileges that the common Cuban doesn't, and they want to preserve that system. And so I think we can engage them all they want, but I think they are going to resist making significant changes, at least until the Castros are gone. And so it's a lot more complicated than it would seem on the surface. What we're doing is something that every other country in the world except us did for 57 years with no results in terms of greater economic or political freedom. So somehow the idea that if we go...
But equally, our embargo went on for over 50 years with very little result.
My view is that nobody's policy is going to change that regime until the Castros are dead. And then there is a yearning for a change. Some people in the military government want to go toward more of a North Korean model. Some want to go state capitalism, like crony capitalism, like the ex-Soviet Union or China. Some want to have a more open system. But with the leadership now with the Castros, I think they're the break on that. And when they're gone, all kinds of things are possible. So certainly the embargo was not successful in changing the nature of the regime, but it didn't start off with that in purpose. It was to punish the government for taking billions of dollars of American property without compensation. And then during the Cold War, it was to keep money out of the hands of an expansionist regime that was supporting dictators, and like in Argentina, people forget about that, and also guerrilla movements all around the world. So it was to keep money out of their hands. And but certainly it has not been effective in changing the regime, but it was to be a bargaining tool to use for something in exchange. And I think the critics of the president's travel now are saying, where's the beef? What do we get for the concessions we made? And are we going back to an old day when we were meeting with and supporting military dictators? Because he is a general, he's not a president. And that, so we'll have to see if there's anything positive that comes out of it. I think there's a lot of, I would call it, irrational exuberance in terms of economic possibilities, because there's no purchasing power in Cuba, and the military owns everything, so you have to deal with the military.
Well,
I don't think that the Congress is going to change its stance on the embargo until they see some human rights improvements.
Well, we've hardly mentioned Coral Gables yet in our interview with Coral Gables Mayor, Ambassador Jim Kaysen. We will shortly, though. We'll take a short break and be back with more. Stay with us. And we're back with more Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're speaking with Coral Gables Mayor and Ambassador Jim Kaysen. We're talking about his long career in foreign service, but also he's in his third term as mayor of Coral Gables. Tell me, Jim, it's the 90th anniversary of the Coral Gables founding. Your thoughts on that legacy of Coral Gables and Merrick and such?
Well, we're a very unusual community, one of the first planned communities in Florida, and one of the first in the United States, really. That it was the City Beautiful movement that was sort of a reaction to the industrialist sort of geometric streetscapes and the towns of the early 1900s. And George Merrick came down and to grow basically grapefruits and guava. After a while, he came up with the idea to create a planned city from scratch on roughly 3,000 acres before it was all over. And so he laid out with a tremendous vision a city that included a university, University of Miami, that had a downtown, and that had villages that were meant to make Coral Gables a gateway, sort of a window to the world. So he had South African villages and Chinese and Dutch. And it was unique at the time because after World War I, we were very isolationist as a country. Yet his vision was to make this a Mediterranean-style city, featuring beautiful windy roads and a mixture of community, not only for rich, but also for middle and lower income people. So he laid out plots in different parts of the city to reflect that vision. And for 90 years, the commissioners, the mayors have followed that vision, and we have this beautiful city today. 3 years ago, I went to Xiamen, China, and invited by liberal communities, and we were the only city of under 50,000 from the Western Hemisphere invited. We took silver for the best quality of life in the world. And number two, the USA Today for the most beautiful small city. So it's a city that's been recognized for its beauty, quality of life, and appreciation of nature, trees, sustainability. So it's a wonderful place to live and work and play, and I'm fortunate to be mayor.
With your long diplomatic career, what interested you to become mayor of Coral Gables, and what are your roots there?
Well, actually, after I retired from the Foreign Service, they said, go find some place to live. And I said, wow, I've lived in so many places, because I was also the son of a naval aviator. So I had lived in 19 places in 5 high schools in the U.S. I had lived down in this area when I was 6 and 7 years old, when my father used to fly hurricane hunters out of here in the early 50s.
Out of what airport? So my,
Opa-locka used to fly out of there.
Of course.
And he was... So I had lived down here before, but I lived all over the place. I went to 5 high schools. I really didn't have any roots in the United States, but I'd been through Coral Gables many times, and I said this was such a beautiful city with a university and an airport nearby and a Latin flavor, that my wife's from El Salvador. And so we wanted to be able to use our languages and jump on a plane and go back to places we had been from and had lived in before. So we picked Coral Gables. I never had any plans to become mayor, but I was asked to be by the State Department to be our Inspector General.
They asked you to be mayor.
Well, after I came back as Inspector General of our embassy in Baghdad and Amman, Jordan, some neighbors said, well, if you could look for waste, fraud, and mismanagement in Baghdad, which had a $30 billion budget, you could certainly do it in Coral Gables. And they pointed out that a fresh look at things would be... probably get a lot of support in Coral Gables. So I never crossed my mind. And so I decided to, after talking to some people, that they said you could win. And I researched the city and said I think I could contribute, having been in so many organizations with a different perspective. So I ran and I won. It was my surprise and everybody else's.
Actually, I think you had a 71% majority.
Yeah,
I guess that's a landslide.
Well, in the South, I got 96% in some of the communities like Kings Bay. So I ran on four platforms. I said, I'm a carpetbagger. I'm coming here from, I don't know anybody, and that's why you should elect me. I have no relatives, no brothers-in-law. I don't own the business. I don't know anybody, anything, and I don't know whether Bobby pulled Mary's hair in third grade. And therefore, I can come in fresh, with fresh perspective. I won't stay forever. And I will provide my international expertise to a city which has 122 nationalities, 25 consulates. So I ran on that platform, and I've lived up to that. And I guess people appreciated it, and I think I'm the only ambassador that's a mayor in the United States, so it's an unusual combination, although the work is exactly the same. An ambassador for our country is the ambassador for a city.
Okay, Mayor, can we have a little fun with you?
Sure.
You spoke of your love of languages, and you speak fluently the Guarani language of Paraguay. That's the indigenous language. Something like 94% of the people have spoken that, correct, in Paraguay?
That's right, 94. It's the only bilingual country, really, in Latin America, for some historic reasons. But if you've ever seen the movie The Mission, it's about Paraguay and the importance of music for the Indians. And so just about everybody there speaks Guarani. And when I was in Cuba, when I was
Guarani,
offered the chance to go to...
The pronunciation is Guarani?
Guarani,
right. Okay.
It's one of about 100 Indian groups, and the Jesuits back in the 1700s to protect the Indians from Brazilian slave traders got them together in what they called reducciones and decided to use Guarani as the language for all of the Indians, and it became sort of the indigenous language most used in Paraguay.
Now, you really kind of went crazy with this language. You really, really enjoyed it, I suppose.
I loved it. Well, I've never wanted to go to a country if I didn't know the language, and I was always taught before I went to Italy or Portugal, and I knew Spanish when I joined the Foreign Service. You really can't be effective unless you speak a foreign language, and you really it shows respect for the country. So when I was told I was going to Paraguay and everybody spoke Guarani, I said, well, I have to learn it. So I started with...
Now, do you learn that from Berlitz or something?
No, I learned it in Cuba. I started, the vice nuncio of the Vatican was a Paraguayan, and he said, I can find you a Paraguayan student who is studying medicine in Cuba, who really needs some money, and you can start learning Guarani with him. So I invited him to my house, and I said, let's just start talking. I'll write down the words. We didn't have a book or anything, so I said, I want to learn 500 words of the grammar in 1 month. And then I went back to the State Department, and I asked them to teach me Guarani, and they said, what's that? So I finally found a Paraguayan teaching Spanish who used to teach the Peace Corps who began teaching me one-on-one for 4 months in Guarani, such that I spent all day learning it, and I arrived at post without telling anybody there that I knew Guarani, and I gave my press conference in Guarani, which sort of blew everybody away. And well, I continued to learn it for 3 years. Every day I took two-hour tutoring at lunch.
Well, you more than speak Guarani, you sing it also. In fact, we have a copy of a CD where you recorded of Guarani folk songs. Can we play some of that?
Yeah, sure. I wrote one called, it's called Campo Jurado. It's actually on iTunes.
And, Campo Jurado.
Campo Jurado, which means... it's hard to explain it, but it means a land that I swear I won't abandon. It's about a battle between the Bolivians and the Paraguayans in the 1930s that actually occurred, and the song's about that, those soldiers in that battle.
Now, when they told me this was folk music, I didn't realize it was going to be such a production, but let's play along with it. Our mics are still open, too. Is that you, Jim?
Yes, that's me.
Oh. Uvu kwaru wape, asunye mi hape, tu ataro vape. And you composed the lyrics or both?
I wrote the lyrics. I woke up one night. I had never sung in my life in any language, and I don't read music and I don't play an instrument, but I had been learning the lyrics in advanced Guarani to songs, and the number one soprano in Paraguay asked me to come sing with her at the National Music Festival, which I said to her, I'd never sung in my life. But she
so
said,
you,
well,
you had never even sung karaoke then?
No, nothing, nothing. But my wife knew that I could sing, and I had learned the lyrics to a number of Paraguayan songs. So what happened was, they asked me to go to the National Music Festival with the number one soprano in the country to sing four Paraguayan songs. This was on a Monday. And I said, well, how many people are going to be there? She said, 10,000. I said, oh, my God. And so I said, I'll do it.
Okay. Let's listen a little bit more. Let's listen a little more. It's really very good, Mayor.
So that came to me in a dream. I wrote it, and I got some of the best musicians in Paraguay. And so the 16 songs in the album are all in Guarani. Some very famous songs like Recuerdo Azul, Bacarayi. And then I decided, after that music festival, to make an album. And I gave all the rights to poor kids that had great grades to get out of poverty through learning English. And so we ended up with about 700 kids through funds from my embassy program and the proceeds from my album. And they were the best students. And just a wonderful language, very onomatopoeic. It's, and they've always been, they were doing the Jesuit period, that some of the best musicians in Europe, they played in the orchestras, the Paraguayans.
Well, we're speaking with Coral Gables Mayor, Ambassador James Kaysen, and we're going to take a short break on our program, but we have lots more to come after this. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman is off today. We hope to have her back tomorrow. If not, then certainly Monday. And we resume our conversation with Coral Gables Mayor Jim Kaysen. He's in he's ending his first year of his third term as mayor of Coral Gables. Mayor, you seem to make the South Florida, or actually our worldwide water levels, a big issue of yours, especially in Coral Gables, and you're taking early steps. Do you feel that this is being ignored too long by municipalities?
I do, especially for South Florida. We have unique geology compared to other coastal cities in the United States with limestone. We, as the sea level rises, which it inevitably will, the question is how much and when, we can't build walls around our communities as you could do in Holland, for example, because the water will come up below and seep through. So we have a unique challenge. We're not getting leadership out of the state, really, and the federal government is focusing on sort of disaster relief, but it leaves it then to the mayors and the communities, of which we have 34 municipalities in Miami-Dade. We're all working together in a four-county compact to look at what is it that we can do, what are our risks. And Coral Gables has 47 miles of exposure to the ocean, more than Miami Beach. So we have to, as responsible leaders, begin the dialogue with our citizens and among the mayors and our communities as to the scientific evidence. People can believe it or not. People are going to need to manage their own risk, decide which of these four curve lines that the federal government's come up with about sea level rise, which one you want to accept, and then what, if anything, you or your grandkids are going to do about it. And certainly most of the scientific evidence from around the world indicates that we have at least 51 inches built into sea level already from industrialization over the last 100 and some years, not to count what's going to happen with ice melt and methane release from the permafrost. So that puts a lot of our communities underwater in certainly by 2100, and our grandkids will be alive then. So it's important for us to begin knowing what our risks are, we in Coral Gables have started with what we call LIDAR maps, which are very detailed maps of elevation above sea level. And we placed all of our critical infrastructure on the map so that at least we know what are our lowest pieces of critical infrastructure up to the highest. And then we can begin looking at building codes and other things as the years pass and do things together with our neighbors to save our communities as long as we can.
What on that map most troubles you, Jim?
Well, I was with the new president of Julio Frank of the University of Miami in his first meeting with the trustees of UM with the Commission of Coral Gables and the staff, and I gave him a map, a LIDAR map with University of Miami buildings on it, and I said, your buildings here will be in there 2 feet above sea level. So we both celebrated our 90th anniversary, and I said, for us to have a second 90th anniversary, we need to get the university to join us in looking for solutions. We have a lot of creativity in our universities, and so he adopted as his one of his three main objectives of relevance, making the University of Miami very relevant in terms of research on sea level. So a lot of our, all of our coastal communities are between 1 and 1.1 feet below sea level up to 4 or 5 feet. Then you have a ridge along some of the area that's about 12 feet. But a lot of our gated communities are very low. So they are the ones that would be the first to feel the impacts of rising seas.
We talk about solutions for these. What are more possible solutions? I mean, there's pumping going on in Miami Beach. That doesn't seem like that's going to be an answer.
Today, there is no answer, which is why there will be a lot of money spent, billions, probably hundreds of billions of dollars spent trying to hold back the sea. We're hoping that there'll be something developed over the next, 20 to 50 years that will take heat out of the ocean, carbon sinks, whether it's replanting trees or some kind of giant mechanical devices or mirrors. Nobody really knows right now, but this particular area where we live, from really Fort Lauderdale down, is very low. I mean, you got the Everglades, and to the extent that the Everglades don't get enough fresh water, the salt water as it rises will push into the Everglades, will destroy the aquifers and create lots of islands. So there scientists don't have an answer right now if the sea were to rise 51 inches or much higher, depending what happens and what we do to the atmosphere in the future. So it's a lot of money will be spent, a lot of thought given to it, and hopefully people will come up with some kind of a solution with certain to gain as much time as possible.
We did a program on this about 3 weeks ago on the local ramifications of sea rising. Mostly we dwelled on the coastal areas being inundated, and of course that's the highest priced real estate. But what about people more in the mainland and away from the coast, and also in low income housing?
Well, they're going to be less likely to have the money to move. I mean, this is going to really hurt poor people as well as the people that have the million-dollar mansions. We live off tourism, and the airport's 4 feet above sea level. So if sea level rises, as scientists predict, the tourism will certainly suffer, and there go the jobs. So plus you're going to have a lot of migration from the Caribbean, where you have a lot of low islands, and people will probably come this way. So it's very existential for a city like Coral Gables and for Pinecrest and all of us, which is why 21 mayors got together and we asked the candidates to discuss their views on sea level rise. And Mayor Regalado and I wrote to the organizers of the Republican debate here to ask some questions on that, and they did. They didn't ask all the candidates, but they asked two of them. And we just think that people need to start being aware of what could happen, what's likely to happen, and so they can manage their own risks. But what's going to happen is the mortgage companies, there'll come a time when they want to offer 30-year mortgages when insurance will be very, very high and where bond rating agencies may downgrade cities that haven't made preparations, at least knowing what their risk is. And we are ahead of the game, I think, in South Florida, and that we've already done these maps and have put our infrastructure on there and begun a series of meetings to educate our citizens with FIU and UM, and certainly to be with FAU, to show them what we think is going to happen, and hopefully we'll get their support in the coming years to rebuild, to change our building code so we can build higher and smarter and make sure all our pumping stations are high enough so that we'll have as much time as possible to continue to enjoy South Florida.
So, well, after both you and I are not here anymore, the face of this area should be much, much different.
That's what Hal Wandless, the professor, the head of the geology department at UM, has been showing in a lot of his presentations around South Florida, a map showing what 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 feet will mean to our communities. And, yeah, it's... We're ground zero, so we really have to take a leadership position. Even if the residents are focused on other things, we need to begin the dialogue, begin the research, begin the educational process so that we can be prepared like it would be for a hurricane, for any kind of natural disaster.
Professor Wandless says 5 feet is fairly light in his estimation. It could be much greater.
Yes, he actually thinks that with his research into Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet, not to mention the permafrost, which releases methane, which is 100 times more damaging than the CO2, that you could be 10 feet or more. Every foot means less and less, more and more islands.
We're speaking with Ambassador Jim Kaysen. He's the mayor of Coral Gables, a three-term mayor. He's on the phone from Coral Gables, and we're going to take a short break on Topical Currents. Before we go, let's give a phone number if you'd like to call in with a comment or question, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@wlrn.org. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We resume our conversation with Coral Gables Mayor Jim Kaysen. Jim, one of the real icons of Coral Gables, of course, is the historic Biltmore Hotel. I know at least a few years ago there were some financial problems there. Is the Biltmore on sound financial footing, and there's no fear of losing that great hotel?
No. It's like so many... people after 2008, there was a downturn in tourism and the economy, and they suffered. We had, for a while, they had some delinquencies and we had some legal differences over who was supposed to do what on the Biltmore. We prevailed. The Biltmore Seaway ownership paid everything they owed. They've been on time ever since, and the hotel is booming, and we got a grant to help them maintain the facade. So it's a vibrant part of Coral Gables, and we're really proud to have it. Tour buses every day go and bring people and admire it. The pool where Johnny Weissmuller used to swim and do his Tarzan. It's a wonderful place. And, you know, it used to have gondolas, and we've actually found the gondola house there. It used to have 20 gondoliers from Venice, and they're thinking of perhaps bringing some gondolas back and taking people down to Tahiti Beach on the tours.
It is a fine line to walk to keep the tremendous and beautiful tradition of Coral Gables, but also being of today and looking modern.
Yes, we're in the process now. When I came in, we were pretty sketchy in terms of our economic situation, but we've turned that around. We're one of four cities that have AAA bond rating now in Florida. We've reduced the millage rate for 6 years in a row and brought our reserves up from what would have been $157,000 to almost $120 million in various pots. And and actually have 25% of our operating budget in reserves. And we've codified that through an ordinance to maintain that. So we're in great financial shape, and we're attracting more and more international corporations. We have 160 corporate headquarters for Latin America here. We now have 225 restaurants and a lot of cultural four theaters. And so people want to live in the Coral Gables. Our housing market has rebounded. I think the average house is 700,000 now. Very low unemployment, very low crime rate, and great services. Our police department is one of the best 19 in the country, and our fire department is one of the few class one fire departments where everybody's a paramedic. So we're very proud of the services. People want to live here, and we're looking to attract more corporate headquarters and make it more possible for people to live downtown so they don't need a car and can walk through all the new amenities that include a rejuvenated Miracle Mile that we're starting this month.
It seems that when most South Floridians talk about Coral Gables, they talk about the tough zoning laws, the permitting, the architectural control, the real zealous parking attendance there. Are Coral Gables residents really kind of proud of that in a way, though?
Yes. I mean,
it's a no-nonsense place.
No, this is George Merrick. He said, look, he was the one that said, we're going to be very tough on code enforcement. We want to keep our property values up. So, for example, our code enforcement, we don't allow chain-link fences in the front. We don't allow commercial vehicles to park. You can't paint your house purple. Code enforcement make sure that the houses stay clean and painted, and that's the reason the property values are just soaring in Coral Gables. And since we live off basically property values, that gives us the money, along with the downtown taxes, to be able to lower the tax rate every year and to put, you know, millions and millions back into redoing the streets, the sidewalks. We're in the process of planting 3,000 trees, bringing in beautiful $1 million sculptures to some of our circles and fixing our monuments. So, yeah, it's very important to have strict codes, but we're very friendly to we don't want to collect fines. We want people to comply with the codes so that we can all live in conflict-free with our neighbors and not have somebody do something that affects your quality of life.
Let's take a call or two. We are short on time. I ask our callers to be brief. Kayvon, is that correct, in Miami?
Yeah, almost. My name is Kayvon, and I have lived in Coral Gables. And I want to, first of all, congratulate the mayor because he has a very impressive background and worthy of basically somebody being Secretary of State almost. But I wanted to ask about two things, one very local and one perhaps more international, having to do with Argentina and the United States.
Okay, let's go with the first one.
The local thing is, for example, you have recognized, and part of the obvious value of Coral Gables is a lot of international people want to live and work there. And with the trolley and all such things, you know, people want to walk and perhaps recreate an experience they may get in Latin America or Europe. The question I have is this. Why are shade trees not a part of that? And why do we not have some crosswalks on 37th Avenue or Lejeune so one can get across? And maybe you have to coordinate with the city of Miami, but the way they are on Coral Way, where one can hit a button and the cars have to stop and perhaps walk or do it better.
I understand.
And then the other thing is I have a family member, and she's on the line with me, and she says she can't believe you speak Guarani, and you're the Muruvicha of the city, which is the boss, right?
Okay. So we should we test him out on this?
Yeah, she's got to upgrade him.
On the first one, yes. People understand that a lot of those streets you mentioned are actually controlled by Miami-Dade or Florida Department of Transportation, so we have to work with them in terms of crosswalks and those sorts of things.
Wait just a minute, ma'am. We'll get to you. Go ahead with your answer, Mr. Kaysen.
So what we're trying to, yes, we're planting shade trees all over the place. In fact, we surveyed every tree in Coral Gables and are planting 3,000, mainly oaks and mahoganies. There are going to be many more trees now on Miracle Mile, and we are working with a county-owned crosswalks on Lejeune, down at Cartagena Circle, and the areas you mentioned. So we're very cognizant of the need for that, but since they're not ours and they're controlled by the county, we have to work with them, and we usually will pay for it as long as they will permit it.
So give the lady your regards in Guarani.
In Baixa Panecoe, Ipona,
Muy bien, diploma. Diploma, muy bien.
Si hablo tri, permeco aplica tu hawaisa a mi siminte corregete.
Well,
great to talk to a Paraguayan. Paraguayans are wonderful people.
All right, thank you very much for your call.
Okay.
Okay.
I be sure to hear Guarani.
Okay. It's very nice. Okay. Thank you very, very much. What's next on your agenda, Mr. Mayor?
Well, my son's an American airline pilot and a Navy pilot, so I'm hoping to have more time in the future to travel around to places like New Zealand and take another path I'm not taken. I mean, I will have been mayor for 6 years, and then next year, and I'll probably go off and do something different in the time that's remaining. There's so many interesting things to do in the world, and maybe I'll create a musical group and spend my time singing Guarani songs. Who knows?
How about a number for those people, because it is an educational charity that it supports, of those who'd like to give a CD of those folk songs?
Yeah, they can either, in my office, I sell them for $15, or you can get them on iTunes. Just put James Kaysen or Campo Jorado, and you can download the 16 songs. And it's beautiful music. I picked the best songs that I thought that Paraguay had produced, and I sing them with opera singers and others. It's really some wonderful songs, and very not common for people to realize how great a musical tradition Paraguay has.
Well, you did a really good job on producing and singing on that for an amateur.
Yeah, I just found it was so beautiful music. I just said, well, if they like it, I guess I'll make an album.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure. We want to thank you, Coral Gables Mayor James Kaysen. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on the program. Bye-bye.
And thanks for being with us today. Our program was produced by Polly Landis, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Lead producer is Richard Ives. Of course, as always, it's easy to find free online downloads of this and prior programs at our website, wlrn.org, linked through radio. More information, links, and such, including photos of the Topical Currents Facebook page. Oh, it's that time of year again. The IRS. Tomorrow's program begins with a visit about federal income tax preparation. Yes, April 15th looms, so if you're ready to figure out your own taxes, we'll have the info. We'll also include a portion of our program about identity theft tips from your returns. That's very prevalent these days. Apology to those callers we couldn't get to on the air. This is Joseph Cooper. Remember, Bonnie Berman returns soon. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's all coming up next on Where Else But Public Radio.
Todo te recuerda mi dulce amor junto al lago azul de Pacaraí. Todo te recuerda mi amor, te amo.